From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Barely a day goes by when President Donald Trump doesn't accuse the media of being corrupt, failing, and of course, promoting fake news. It's been a hallmark of his presidential campaign and his presidency. The accusations are accompanied by his own relentless spewing of lies. Now, a new edition of the best-selling book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, highlights how much of our current discourse is not new. James W. Loewen is the best-selling and award-winning author of the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, which has sold 2 million copies. His other books include Lies Across America, Lies My Teacher Told Me About Christopher Columbus, and Sundown Towns. He also wrote Teaching What Really Happened and The Mississippi Chinese Between Black and White. He edited The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. He's won the American Book Award, the Oliver Cromwell Cox Award for Distinguished Anti-Racist Scholarship, the Spirit of America Award from the National Council for Social Studies, and the Gustavus Myers Outstanding Book Award. He is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont and lives in Washington, D.C., where he now joins me on the phone from to discuss the brand new edition of his famous book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your History Textbook Got Wrong. It has a new introduction for the Donald Trump era. Welcome to the program, James Loewen.
Hey, I'm glad to be with you.
So I have actually thought about you many times during the time that the Trump administration has been sort of rewriting our history and rewriting even current events. Is it the Trump presidency that prompted you to come out with this new edition?
Well, not really. It was something kind of related in a way. What first got me thinking, you maybe remember this guy, Milo Yiannopoulos.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
For listeners, I have never met him, but he is apparently a right-wing provocateur who is not only a member of the alt-right, but he also actually comes out in favor of having sex with children, let's put it that way. And Simon & Schuster gave him a $100,000 advance for a provocative memoir by him. Well, my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, was a bestseller for Simon & Schuster, still is. Lies Across America about historic sites was actually, I think, the best-selling book in public history, also for Simon & Schuster. And I'm sitting there saying, well, you know, I don't really exactly want to be associated with this publisher that would not exactly seek out Milo, I guess, but certainly make an offer to him of a six-figure advance. So that started me thinking about what do I want to do. And I wound up with a new paperback edition published by the pioneering hardbound publisher, The New Press, that published it in the first place, way back when it first came out in the first edition in 1994. And I'm really happy with it. It's always nice working with the New Press. Back when they sold it to Simon & Schuster, they didn't think they were big enough to handle it. But they've been successful, and now they think they are. And I'm delighted to make it possible for them. Hmm. Now, Trump in a way is related to the coming out of people like Milo Yiannopoulos out from underneath rocks, because he has, in a sense, legitimized the alt-right and moved the goalposts of what stands, what demarcates acceptable discourse. And I'm very sorry that he has. And so I do talk about some of the issues that he's raised in his campaigning and in his presidency.
So it seems as though right from the start, Trump made it clear that facts wouldn't get in the way of his interpretation of reality when, after his inauguration, he claimed, despite so much evidence to the contrary, that his inauguration was the best attended ever inauguration. Did that signal to you at that moment that we were in for a very... interesting ride, if you will.
Exactly. And in a way, there's some things that have been going on in academia for a long time that kind of played into Trump thinking and the thinking of some of his supporters. But just talking about the inauguration crowd, on the very, not the very first page, but page XVI, I'm looking at my own kind of pre-publication copy of the new edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Then on page XVI, which, you know, kind of comes before page one, the way they do these things.
The Roman numerals,
I have a picture. Yes. I have a picture of Obama's crowd and Trump's crowd, side by side, laid out exactly the same on the page. And gosh, you know, Obama's crowd looks more than twice as large. So there's something going on with alternative facts. It doesn't seem to hold up. So I think that's a cool way of getting readers, including students. I mean, fifth graders have been reading Lies My Teacher Told Me. They can look at these two things and say, no, wait a minute, you can't just have two different facts. One of these facts is not a fact. One of these facts is false. And that's, of course, the kind of thinking that I want to encourage.
Right. And of course, Donald Trump's ardent supporters will not believe truth and facts, no matter how obviously the president lies. And we, how much of that do you think traces back to poor education in the United States, as you've used, you know, your many history books to point out the lies that are told to Americans about our past, the sort of glossing over of the genocides we've been involved in, and the, you know, and so many other misdeeds. Is it that poor education and lack of critical thinking that helps in part to explain why Trump supporters will believe the president no matter what he says?
I think in particular, history and social studies are mistaught in our K-12 public schools and in many Catholic and private schools as well. I think what becomes important is kind of a numbing boosterism. We might call it nationalism. I'm not going to call it patriotism. I take my definition of a patriot from this guy named Frederick Douglass. People may have heard of him. And he has a great quote about, he says, I call him, now he's using the him pronoun, but he was really good on women's rights, so we got to give him a pass on that. But I call him a true patriot who rebukes his country for its sins and does not excuse them. Well, I think that that's exactly what we need. Of course, we need to take credit for the things we've done right, but we've got to face openly the things that we've not done right. And a nationalist, on the other hand, says, my country, right or wrong, and furthermore, we've never been wrong, and if we ever have, it was just because we had bad information, and if you say anything to the contrary, I'm going to hit you upside the head with this here 1,100-page textbook in American history called something like Triumph of the American Nation, you know? So I think that after students come out of a course like this, they are not equipped to look at, for that matter, what the textbook says and critique it. They are only equipped to remember it, supposedly, and write down the answer to 50 or 60 stupid little questions at the end of each chapter, and then clear those synapses out to make space for the next chapter. So the problem does begin, therefore, in our high school education.
Now, isn't it the responsibility of our schools to not just teach children facts or some interpretation of facts, but also to teach them critical thinking? And I know in your book, you've taken that on, in your various books, you've taken on the issue of critical thinking. How important is it for that to be taught as a skill separate from just, you know, absorbing and regurgitating facts?
That's exactly the point. I even actually talked with one K-12, well, she was a U.S. History teacher in high school, who says, if you can Google it, don't teach it. And she's got a point. That is, you know, like, when was U.S. Grant president? Well, I happen to know that one. But, you know, do I really care whether you, Sonali, know that it was? It'd be nice if you kind of knew, well, it was somewhere around the 1870s, you know, as opposed to, say, the 1970s or the 1770s. But, you know, to know these actual little, I call them twigs, because they're small facts. They're not, you know, we're not just missing the forest for the trees. We're teaching these twigs that people memorize and then forget. And I think it's, of course, much more important to teach critical thinking and to teach the idea that there is such a thing as fact. And let me go off on a riff here just for a minute, if I may.
Sure.
I get in trouble with some elegant history teachers on this point. There's a phrase that has been going around graduate schools now for 20 years. It goes something like this. Why should we privilege one account above others with the label true? And so we have all kinds of academicians who, coming out of a rather elegant philosophical position about alternative truths and so on, that wants to be nuanced and so on, says, well, this account is maybe more useful, this account is more appropriate for us in the present, but they're not willing to use black and white terms like this account is true or this account is not true. And I think that's part of the problem, because I actually think that a great deal of history is true or is not true and relates to a bedrock of fact. My example I give, it's kind of a little shtick I do. I say, when somebody tells me, why should we privilege one, that whole phrase, I say, right, and the Civil War began in 1875. It grew out of a pay dispute in Nevada between the Union Pacific Railroad and its Chinese workers. And they look at me as if I'm crazy and their jaw drops, and they say, but that's not true. And of course, it's not true. It's off by 15 years, and it's off by cause, and it's off by place, and everything about it is a lie indeed. It's false. Well, you can say, well, that's too easy. Yeah, we know the Civil War did start in 1861, and it started in South Carolina, but that's too easy. Well, what about this question, which is very much on people's minds these days? Why did the South secede? All right. Now, I think that's absolutely clear from the historical record, too. It seceded because it wanted to maintain and expand and make secure the system of slavery. Okay, so it's all about slavery. Well, the South, of course, after 1890, they said exactly that in 1860 and 61, but after 1890, the representatives of the South, we call them neo-Confederates, started saying, no, no, it's about states' rights. And if you go to Gettysburg, you'll see monuments put up by South Carolina, for instance, which was the first state to secede. It says something like the main memorial they put up to our fallen soldiers here, states' rights was their credo here. Well, that's precisely BS. This is a technical term we use in sociology. It means bad sociology, okay? It's precisely bad sociology, because as they were clear, they were mad at states like Pennsylvania and Iowa and New Hampshire. They list 16 states that have tried to exercise states' rights, for example, on behalf of runaway slaves. Or they're mad at New Hampshire because New Hampshire lets black folks vote. Well, who the heck votes in America in 1859, 1860? Is nobody's business but the state. But South Carolina makes it their business. They say you have no business letting blacks vote, because they cite the infamous Dred Scott decision of 1857, which says black folks got no rights that white folks need to respect. And here these white folks in New England are letting black folks vote. This is an outrage. In other words, secession is all about racism and about slavery as a specific form of racism. And You can't get around that. It's not about states' rights. They did not secede on behalf of states' rights. So historians are not used to being so black and white, as it were, themselves. And so I think we have actually helped mess this discussion up in our arcane discussions in the academy.
Right, because it's hard when you say something is specifically true, you've made a commitment to it. And in the academy, of course, we have all sorts of claims about relativism and, well, what is completely true. And that has been abused and distorted. And you have Kellyanne Conway saying, using the term alternative facts then. And so these days, the issue of fake news is being raised as if it's a new thing that's been pushed because of social media and the ease of sharing information. But isn't fake news just another word for an old phenomenon, which is propaganda?
In fact, what's really kind of cool is that in my new preface, in the new edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me, I have a cartoon from a newspaper in 1894 that shows a newspaper guy running around selling a newspaper, and it's labeled fake news. Well, it's labeled, one of them is labeled humbug news, fake news, and so the term itself goes back at least to 1894. So there's been a lot of accusations that the media are biased for at least 100 and however many years that is, 125 or 30.
So when you have a situation as we do today, where a large swaths of the population don't have very good critical thinking skills, and this isn't just something that the right struggles with, even some people on the left struggle with it. What is our, what is the solution for us to try to clarify facts? If we can't even agree on facts, how do we move forward to solutions for the problems that we struggle with today? Are we to write off the current population and simply try to work on the kids of the future and you know, suggest that their reading materials include your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, the new edition? Are there things that adults can do who have to, you know, make very educated decisions on how to vote and who to choose for as their representatives?
I think that adults are absolutely reachable. In fact, earlier this year, I reached a batch of them. I was speaking at this big seminar held in Richmond, Virginia, about what to do about Confederate statues and monuments. And it was very, very interesting because this seminar took place about a month before Charlottesville. And Charlottesville is so important that I actually use the term BC for before Charlottesville, because Charlottesville altered the rhetorical landscape for discussing not only Confederate monuments, but racist and white supremacist monuments of any kind. And, of course, you've got some of those in California. Hmm. The mayor, who is African-American, the mayor of Richmond, and, of course, elected by African-Americans in a majority African-American city, he had said removal of the monuments, particularly those on Monument Avenue, which is a very famous street that has five, maybe even six different Confederate generals and one admiral, and then Arthur Ashe at the end, the black tennis player. It's the most famous batch of Confederate monuments in the world, and he had said removal is not on the table. Well, after Charlottesville, he said removal is on the table, and then that was very interesting. But to get back to your question, I saw myself actually reaching some of the neo-Confederates in my audience, and the way I did it was two things. First, I used humor. I commended them for at least knowing a bunch of stuff about the Civil War, and I told this joke. I collect stupid questions that Americans ask when they visit NPS sites and other historic sites. And by gosh, some of them are pretty stupid. And the one I'm referring to now is at Civil War sites from Gettysburg all the way down to Louisiana. Visitor after visitor says, isn't it amazing how they fought all these Civil War battles in parks? Okay? And And my audience cracked up. The neo-Confederates laughed especially hard because there is a problem there, maybe a cause and effect problem, shall we say. So that softened them up, kind of. But then I quoted the primary sources, and this is the key point I want to make to you right now and to your listeners. If you actually hold that the Confederacy seceded for states' rights, then you have to have a theory of universal lying. Why did they all say that they were seceding against states' rights? Why did they all say that they were seceding for slavery? And so I pointed out that, in fact, and I read from the documents, the South Carolina Declaration of the Causes of Secession and so on, and in the question period, and I deliberately set myself up to be the last speaker of the day, in the question period, a 60, 65-year-old white Virginian, clearly moving, working on trying to think about all these things for maybe the first time in a way, he said, well, is it really as simple as just the one cause? It's just plain slavery. That's all. And I said to him openly what I just said to you but had not said openly in my talk. I said, well, if you think it is something else, then you have to come up with a theory for universal lying. And I saw that click, and he nodded right there while he was standing up asking the question. So not everybody's reachable. But I think some people are reachable at any age, and you have to reach them with real facts. And that gets us back to how we started in the first place. There still are such things as real facts. Our current administration being damned about this, and we have to make sure that people recognize that there are facts. And these facts are the ones that make a difference when we're discussing this matter.
Finally, Jim, in the preface to your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, the new edition, you say, decades ago in Mississippi, I learned that history can be a weapon. It had been used against my students. Today, we have a situation where we have this terrible attack on immigrants in the country, the scapegoating of immigrants, and that, you know, all of these have echoes in the past, and you see students being and young people being bludgeoned with policies that have been removed from historical context. How important is it for us to contextualize the stories we see today in a real, you know, factual history of the past?
Well, I think the most important single thing we need to do is become less ethnocentric as a people. And it ties in with nationalism, with this idea, we're always right, blah, blah, blah. It even ties in with this whole issue of Trump trying to get NATO to pay more, and it's all you people's fault for what you're doing to NATO. We have to realize that the United States, in its foreign policy, has typically, but often, allied ourselves with backward dictators around the world, that we have far and away more bases around the world than any other country, in fact, than all other countries combined, and so on. And so it doesn't help us think about what we should do next when we believe to begin with that we are kind of the exception. We are American exceptionalists. We are the exceptionally good. We're the country that tries to protect the peace of the world, etc. Maybe not so much. That's not even what we try to do. We're not trying to protect the peace of the world so much. So this gets us into a whole new bag that we don't have to have time to discuss right here on the program. But I do think that our thinking about the role of America in the world is, again, messed up by how our history is taught in high school, especially since only one out of every six Americans has ever taken a course in history after they left high school.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, James Loewen. Good luck with the new edition of your best-selling book. Really appreciate it.
Okay, I hope everybody will enjoy Lies My Teacher Told Me if they haven't read it. And if you read it and you like it, then I want you to give it, my publisher hates it when I say this, give it to somebody else, preferably maybe to a high school history teacher.
Great idea. Thank you again so much, Jim.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with the best-selling and award-winning author James Loewen. We've been discussing the brand new edition of his famous book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your History Textbook Got Wrong. It has a new introduction for the Donald Trump era. The book has sold 2 million copies worldwide. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.